The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, we had talked about having mentioned pay on this week, but we actually moved that out to next week because of the Fed announcement and some of the things that are happening in the market right now.
Well, there's a lot that's happened this last week that I think is very important, and a lot that's happening this week in terms of the Euro meeting. We've got the Euro leaders meeting on the 28th and 29th, and that's absolutely critical to knowing what their course is. What is the course ahead of them? Is it closer integration, or is it more disintegration? And that's what I think we should maybe not look forward to, but anticipate this
week. Well, and, you know, George Soros is not my favorite guy, but he did come out and say that this meeting could make or break the euro. I mean, he's basically giving the warning right now that people should pay attention to what comes out of this, because we may see the destruction of what we see now in that currency.
And we'll talk about this in a few minutes, but I think it's worthy of note that there's a tremendous amount of contention between the players that are showing up. And you've got the French, who now are definitely socialist and sort of waving the red flag, if you will. You've got the Germans, who are definitely still saying, we have enough money to pay our bills, but not enough money to pay yours. And you still have the Greeks, who are saying, but why won't you pay ours? Because, after all, we're peace-loving good people. Haven't you tried our olive oil lately?
Well, David, as all this is happening over in Europe, you know, over on this side of the Atlantic, we were talking about what the Federal Reserve was going to do. And, you know, the announcement last week, I don't know that it was quite what the markets were looking for, the extension of twist.
And it didn't come as a surprise to us. There was no jazz for the speculators.
Right.
And this is what people were anticipating. You saw the difference throughout the week between the commodities markets and players in the commodity space versus equities players and equity investors. Equity investors were holding on to hope that, yes, in fact, QE3 would be announced. It needed to be. It should be. It must be. We hope it will be. That was kind of the trend that was in the equity market coming into the Fed announcement, whereas you already had equities selling off multiple days in advance of that, saying there's not a chance, not this time around. It's not desperate enough. And frankly, the commodities markets nailed it, because with the Dow at nearly 13,000, there's really no panic in the financial space,
right?
Not in the U.S. market. So,
well, and David, let's just bring up the fact that you're on financial TV often now, and, you know, the average interview is maybe 4 to 5 minutes long. People's attention spans have come to be so incredibly short. You know, they're waiting for the next Fed announcement, or they're waiting to see if the sun rises tomorrow. You know,
well, and I think that's worth looking back in time a little bit, because to distinguish between today's speculator and the stock market versus yesterday's investor, you can look at the average hold of an investment, and it was 10.4 months when you go back to a date as recently as 1999, and that was the era of day traders. Prior to 1999 and the sort of 10.4 month average hold for an investment, the 1926 to 1999 period, people held stocks for as long as 3.7 years.
And that's the average. So, you know, a lot of people might be holding 10, others 1, but we're talking about the average was almost 4 years.
Now it's counted in days, with Apple being an example of a long-term buy and hold story. 45 days on average is how long shares of Apple are held by your U.S. investor.
So if you're an Apple holder of 45 or more, you are a very long-term
investor.
Very
long-term investor. The average holding period for the S&P 500, the index that is 5 days. So what's happened, Kevin, is we don't have an investor community anymore. We have a speculator community, and speculators want juicy news bits to trade on.
Well, let me ask you about that, though. They're inspiring speculators with financial TV. They want juicy bits of information to trade on, but do they stand a chance? I mean, we've got computers that are operating thousands of procedures in a single second.
So if you're booking profits at the end of the day, if you're booking profits at the end of the week or at the end of the month, now you really are a long-term investor.
Right.
Again, the era of investing has been co-opted by high-frequency traders, by computer algorithms, and essentially they're looking for pennies to pocket. They're not looking for big swings. They're not looking for macroeconomic trends. It literally is 1 cent here, 2 cents there, one direction or the other, it doesn't matter, and they're making it up on volume.
So the vision of the man in the suit sitting on the end of the park bench reading the Wall Street Journal, determining what he's going to do next for the long term, that's just sort of the fallacy of the past at this point.
It's there, but it's like someone not recognizing that the weather has changed.
Right.
And that same person is sitting on the park bench in a pair of shorts when, in fact, the storm clouds are rolling in and it's getting ready to snow. More appropriately, if he was sitting on the park bench, he should be sitting in a down parka. Absent from the market today are those individual investors who are counting on equities to bring home their dreams of retirement. They're gone. They've been discouraged. Normal market behavior with normal investors participating, we don't think that'll reemerge until you see black pools come into the light of day, until you see the millisecond trading of computer codes limited and frankly, more heavily regulated.
Well, let me ask you about that, though. Explain what you mean by black pools. What are black pools, David?
Well, essentially, you're seeing volume shift away from exchanges. The New York Stock Exchange, the American Exchange, we look at these exchanges and say, well, this is, of course, where stocks are traded. Actually, there's dark pools or black pools, and these are off-market exchanges where people can buy and sell on a private basis.
Right.
In other words,
that doesn't show up in the price on the market because you're not monitoring that black pool.
And what owners of large blocks of stock are trying to accomplish in using black pools or dark pools is getting out of a position or into a position without giving a market indication. In other words, if someone begins to know that I'm trying to buy 100,000 shares of a company or 1 million shares of a company or 5 million shares of a company, and they can see that I'm going to buy 5 million shares or I'm going to buy a large stock, they'll begin to bid up the price knowing that I have more buying yet to do. Yet in a black pool, I can do that more or less on a quote-unquote private basis or anonymous basis.
Well, let me ask you a question then, David. Is it going to take a crash to start to see things come back into line? Because I, as the average investor, can't go and I can't compete with that. I can't compete in milliseconds.
Well, right. And I don't think you will see any regulation or change to the way the stock market functions today until you do have a crash, because if you were to implement those regulations today, in fact, you would be precipitating a crash because you would be eliminating 60 to 80% of the volumes that remain. That's 60 to 80% of the shares that are traded you would see go away if you regulated as high-frequency traders.
Well, and when we talk about regulation, Dave, I mean, you and I both, and I think our listeners understand, we're not looking for just undue regulation, thousands of pages of, like, Dodd-Frank type of regulation, but some sort of symmetry to the markets where people have some sort of a fighting chance, some sort of, I don't want to say fairness necessarily, but equal playing field.
Yeah, when I talk about desiring more regulation, that's not a rejection of sort of ingrained free market principles,
right.
Not at all. The capital markets are being destroyed by a few trading firms that have found a very clever way to move at the speed of light, while the average investor is still moving in real time, not exactly light speed.
Well, you know, Alan Newman has written about that. He's talking about the fact that the average guy just can't get that trade in and out. And, you know, it may take thousands of trades that a computer could do
right.
by the time the guy could press the button twice.
And Newman notes that last September, shares of Yahoo were trading on quotes that didn't even exist until 190 milliseconds after the execution.
So
you've got shares that are trading on quotes that didn't even exist until 190 milliseconds after the execution of the trade. Where is the SEC?
Right.
Where is the SEC? So here's some of the problem with dark pools is things happen that perhaps shouldn't happen. And who is responsible for them? Who is pulling the strings, who's making the investments, who's taking the positions, who's liquidating? Is this a place where there needs to be a little bit more light brought in? I think so.
Well, and speaking of light, though, David, it is possible now, you know, the closer you get to the speed of light, the slower time goes. But if you can exceed the speed of light, you could go back and actually buy shares that didn't have a price until afterwards.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's what I'm saying is this feels like a meeting of the movies of Wall Street.
Right.
And Minority Report.
It's a little science fiction here.
Exactly. So yeah. Minority Report, you remember where you've got the group, basically law enforcement, who's looking ahead and anticipating your thoughts, knowing that, oh, you're frustrated with this person, and you might kill them. Therefore, we're arresting you on the suspicion of, it's an amazing thing to speculate on what will happen in the future and make a decision retroactively based on a future contingent event. It's a future contingent event, and yet algorithms are trading shares as if those future contingent events were already realities.
Well, and I'm feeling played the sucker because I don't believe someone has exceeded the speed of light. And I'm looking at the stock market right now.
Which is why the SEC should be all over this.
Okay.
Well, and again, thanks to Alan Newman. We've invited him to be on the commentary in coming weeks, and you won't want to miss that when he joins us. But looking at the equity markets from the standpoint of volume, we just talked about that, but now volume of liquidations versus sales,
right.
Insider selling is off of its peaks. It's not what it was a few weeks or months ago, but it is rapidly increasing in the retail sector. And that's very interesting because what we need as an economy, what we need as a country is for our economy to recover, and we're geared towards recovery for the consumer, and that's not happening.
So if we were to go back to the middle part of this last decade, I mean, is insider trading unusual now versus then?
Well, in fact, at present, it's 2 to 3 times the liquidation volume. That period, 2006 to 2010, yeah, and that includes the 2008 and 9 period, early 2010.
The crisis years.
Yeah, the crisis years where CEOs could have said, hey, I'm not sure that I want all of my eggs in one basket. You know, I may love the company that I run, but no, actually, we're seeing that kind of liquidation now. Amazon, as you mentioned, that's probably the absurd example, but 19,000 shares bought, so that's the buy side,
okay.
People entering the store, so to say, and 56.6 million shares sold.
There's that 3,000-to-1 ratio.
Huh. I mean, 2960. Yeah. 2,960.
Okay. Let's be fair.
It's 3,000-to-1.
Okay. All right.
This is the issue. We've got negative quarter two pre-announcements, which are running at about 3.6 times greater than the number of positive pre-announcements.
All right. And now, explain what that is. All right, a negative quarter two pre-announcement. Companies every quarter announce whether they're going to have greater earnings than
this last week. I was on Bloomberg. We just had a decent quarter. What does this quarter look like? Does next quarter look like? And they're basically saying, no, lower your expectations. There's some headwinds. We've got some things to deal with.
Right.
And so when people begin to pre-announce, they're basically setting the bar as low as possible or low enough to where expectations aren't hurt and the share price isn't hurt on the basis of expectations being disappointed.
You know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of the honest doctor before the shot. Okay, there are some shots. Tetanus is one of them that hurts. Okay, and I always appreciate a doctor coming on ahead of time and saying, you know what, this is going to hurt a little bit, but it won't last forever.
Right. So. Well, yeah, and we talked about this on Friday in our written comments, but yeah, about 3.6 times greater numbers of negative pre-announcements versus positive pre-announcements, and it's for good reason. You look at a company like General Mills. General Mills is improving their sales. They're having a problem. Their input costs are on the rise. Commodity costs are on the rise. And guess what? They can't infinitely increase the price of Cheerios.
Well, no, they just infinitely decrease the size of the box.
That's
We've talked about that before.
That's an option. They can shrink the box. They can change the color scheme. White is the new black. Now, I mean, there's things that they can do to obscure the fact that they are increasing costs, even if they're not increasing the sticker price. But what they're up against, Kevin, this is the real challenge. They are fighting the consumer's budget, and the consumer is fighting to stay alive. And so when they increase costs, they risk losing market share.
Right.
And that's what is hurting a company like General Mills in this kind of an environment. You'd think, yes, it's a great inflation hedge. It's something that they're tied to commodities. They're going to have to increase their prices. But listen, the consumer doesn't have to pay the higher price. They can always move to a generic. They can always move to another brand. They can move to an off-brand of Cheerios. They can move to an off-brand of Green Giant. They can move to an off-brand of Yoplait. So you don't have to buy Yoplait to be interested in yogurt. And that hurts General Mills. This is what we're talking about. Companies are addressing this. Insiders at those companies are saying, we don't like what we see on the horizon.
Right.
We don't like it enough that we're willing to take action and change our own personal portfolios to reflect the dark clouds on the horizon. Are these terribly dark or are they just semi-dark? All I know is that at least for Amazon, 2,960-to-1 is one heck of a statement.
Yes, and the CEOs know this. Now, David, we've been talking about the economic, and here in the United States, we can say, all right, I'm not going to buy that type of cereal, okay? But we've seen worldwide inflation, even though it's not completely out of control right now, affect the prices of food to the point where it actually upturned or overturned governments. Now, I'm looking at Egypt as an example. Just recently, with the wheat prices going up the last couple of years, we started to see riots. We started to see an overturn of the government. Now, here we've got the Muslim Brotherhood running Egypt.
It'll be interesting to see how this plays out because in a context, not today, but perhaps tomorrow, in a context of rapidly rising inflation,
right.
You've got a constituency that believes the Muslim Brotherhood is going to do a better job than Mubarak or anyone else, not realizing that commodity prices really are determining what happens in the marketplace.
Right.
And if their frustration is relating to being able to feed their families, the frustration will fall on the Muslim Brotherhood as well. The Brotherhood won with a narrow margin. And this is, I think it's important to look at the election in Egypt.
It was almost a flip of the coin.
We've got Mideast volatility, if for no other reason than you've got countries that are dependent on oil revenues, and you've just seen oil prices decline by 25%,
right,
which does kind of put a crimp on your spending if you had adjusted to those higher levels. So yes, oil's below 80 and could very well see the low 70s, even 65 as an absolute low. Why? Because we've got a lot of it. And listen, the Brotherhood wins by a narrow margin. This is the issue, because it's not just Mideast volatility given the price of oil being at a low ebb. That kind of a thing disrupts a country like Russia far more than it would the Middle East. Military generals are going to have to get on board with the Brotherhood, or they're going to stage a bloody coup. And I think that's unlikely at this point.
Well, and David, let's go backwards and look at Egypt as a, not necessarily as an aggressor against Israel, but there have been statements made this week that are already showing that from the other side, the old Anwar Sadat, Menachem Begin talks, those things seem to be part of history at this point with Egypt.
Well, you'd like to see in the first week of leadership something different than Mohamed Morsi's quote of the new capital of Egypt is likely to be Jerusalem, Allah willing.
All right. Yeah, so he's already got his sights on Jerusalem.
Minorly controversial, again, sort of Mideast volatility, not just the oil price, not just Muslim Brotherhood, but a few views that, frankly, aren't that friendly to Israel. And we'll have to see. Maybe he's nothing in the party. Frankly, they popped him out of nowhere since their first choice candidate was unallowed because of a tie to the U.S., family tie to the U.S.
Well, so clearly there's nothing to worry about in the Middle East, because the oil price usually tells you just about how scared you're supposed to be about that part of the world.
Well, the thing is, you've got a divided culture. In this election, it was a 50-50 split, essentially.
Right.
I mean, it ended up being like 51.3 compared to 47.7. I mean, it was very, very close.
Right.
Two out of seven or eight in the field, and two of them got all the votes. It was a dead heat. And again, you've got the reform-oriented Muslim Brotherhood versus the old regime, the military-connected candidate. The Brotherhood has received glowing reports for its charitable work and social welfare programs. That's the way it's viewed domestically. And we just have to keep a watchful eye on it and see if the old treaties, as you mentioned, are upheld, and
right,
if the non-Islamist communities inside Egypt are in fact respected. You've got a small but reasonably sized Christian community within Egypt, and we'll just have to see what develops there over the next few months.
Okay, but David, the statement that was made about Jerusalem, it's fascinating. We're starting to see things break down even worldwide as far as the views of the Middle East. I mean, the CFR right now is almost encouraging Iran to have nuclear weapons so that it brings a balance of power to the region.
Kevin, you really know how to make my stomach churn. Clearly, there's nothing to worry about in the Middle East. The CFR suggests that the smartest thing we can do is restore a balance of power in the Middle East by letting Iran develop the bomb. This is the best thinking that the CFR can come up with. These are the guys who are, whether we like it or not, leading us towards a global, you know, power structure. And they think that Iran, or at least one writer for foreign affairs, thinks that Iran should have the bomb and that will bring peace to the Middle East.
David, we were looking at the Middle East, but we've got clients and we've got people that we talk to who are looking at...
Just one last point on Egypt, because here's what that article assumes, and this is where I think we're missing many things, whether it's Wall Street or geopolitics, and it's that we assume that the world is run by rational actors. And I'm just wondering if anyone is checking their assumptions. Is anyone checking their assumptions? Because to assume that Iran can have the bomb and that is a move towards world peace or Middle Eastern peace... Yes, we're assuming that the world is full of rational actors, just as we would assume when you go to investing that we have a community of rational actors. This is not what defines the market. We define the market in terms of the swings of greed and fear and rationality as something that we paste on top, pretending that it exists and justifying the actions that we have as best we can with rationality. But truly, there are no rational actors in the marketplace, nor in the Middle East.
Well, is this not why you have to protect yourself? You protect your finances, you protect your family, you do what you can do. We've had clients and friends of ours in the past who've been saying, you know, we've got to get out of this country. We've got to get out of the United States. We're going to move to Ecuador. We're going to move to Paraguay. We're going to move to, you know,
Belize.
That's fine. But the thing is, you have to look at the structure in Egypt. Okay, just look at how quickly Egypt changed. Now we have a Muslim Brotherhood president.
Right. So going back to the Southern Hemisphere,
right,
the ousting of the Paraguayan president over the weekend. Fascinating. It's an absolutely fascinating study in the instability of the democratic process.
Well, and you just got back from Paraguay, what, 3, 4, 5 months ago?
Yeah, it was a 2-hour Senate hearing. and the defense was denied time requested to prepare a response. There was no even response. It was just basically a legislative coup. 39-4, the Senate ousts the president. The vice president steps into the role until the new election, it's about a year from now. Why do we mention it? Well, democracy in other parts of the world is frailer than we know, frailer than you know, with the practice of the rule of law being more an issue of convenience. It's not something that is common practice, but it's an issue of convenience and not something that can be taken for granted.
Well, and when you went to South America, David, you were talking about you sort of need to be friends with the cops. You need to be friends with the cab drivers. You need to be friends. And I'm talking about in quotations.
You need to be friends with the guys at the top, even to the president.
As long as you have a little cash in your hand to be friends with.
It's the land of friends. But it seems that it's fairly fickle.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you're friends with the guy at the top. You got to create new friends. This is fascinating because you would be taking the wrong side of the bet if you ever counted on political stability in Latin America.
Well, and is this not a message for the person who's maybe reading material that says, hey, you know, South America is the next great United States.
Buy a place in Chile, buy a place in Argentina, buy a place in Ecuador.
Yeah.
You're talking about one bullet away from being in a banana republic.
Right.
We've gone through a period of credit excess and global growth where that has not been in the cards. You've actually had relative stability in Chile since about 1974. Now, would I take that for granted, given a recent track record? No, I wouldn't, because I'd say what has created sort of peace on earth and goodwill towards men is money, and lots of it, credit that's flowed freely, and the opportunity for all, which means nobody is fighting for their own existence, and socialists and communists sort of fade into the backdrop as capitalism, quote-unquote, has its day in the sun.
Well, and you know what's interesting, Dave? There's a word picture or an analogy for governments that come and go, because money comes and goes as well. You know, on my wall in the office, I've got a number of paper currencies that all, when I hung them up, had value. And now, none of them do. Over the last 25 years working here, I've just put paper currencies up from various countries, and none of them have that value. Now, the thing that we've been continually putting into portfolios during that entire time was something that still has value and more of it. I mean, I'm mentioning gold right now because it represents a solid base when everything else is changing.
Gold dynamics in the last week or two have been fascinating. The consolidation continues. We've got converging moving averages, and this is very constructive in my opinion because it's always immediately preceded a move higher. Mm. The next major move should bring the Dow gold ratio to a 5-to-1 ratio.
So, David, where are we at now? 7.5, 8, something?
8-to-1 now. The next major move brings us to 5-to-1 on the ratio. That would be some configuration of $10,000 on the Dow and $2,000 gold, $7,500 on the Dow and $1,500 gold, $15,000 on the Dow, $3,000 gold. I think pretty likely is a $10,000-$2,000 split, even in this calendar year, perhaps early next year.
Well, and that brings a great point. You know, what we're not measuring in is the fickle dollar. I mean, it's how much of the Dow can you buy with an ounce of gold?
Yep.
We've said this many times, and there are ratios that are pretty consistent.
And the change nominally is less impressive than the change relatively, because
right.
When you're looking at your increase in purchasing power, you're talking about a 36.5% gain in gold buying of Dow shares versus that same sort of $2,000 gold price from current levels, which is about a 26% increase. So 26 versus 36.5, you've got a far better rate of return when you're pricing things in relative terms versus nominal terms. The nominal term is going to be ultimately what is deceptive anyways, because as you mentioned, it's in terms of a particular currency. And you assume that you have some reference point of stability there, and you don't, not in a floating currency environment.
Well, and here's the strange thing. Okay, if you were to talk to a Wall Street broker, most financial planners, guys who were trained by what I would call the paper side, they would always say that gold is a risk asset. It's one of those things you put in, but boy, don't put too much in because it's sure dangerous.
Well, we're finally seeing normal trading in the metals where that confused identity of gold as a risk asset is set aside for a more historically grounded and realistic view, which is gold is the best insurance, the best collateral, least likely asset to fail. This is Richard Russell from earlier this week, where he starts by asking this question, what do we do now? My answer is that we prepare for the long term of frustration and slow and deceptively lower prices. I think at this time, the best position is cash, gold bullion coins, and loads of patience. To me, where he ends, Kevin, is probably where we should begin our investment process, not in trying to figure out what asset class is the best,
right,
but what makes an investor. better than the next and able to endure any market condition, whether it's a bull market or bear market. And patience is that enduring quality which will determine or determine the success or unhinge the success of an investor.
Well, and you know, you're talking about that patience, but you're going to see quite a bit of volatility, especially in something, say, like silver, where it can go way up and it can come way down. But there's a general trend along with gold. If you watch it, it's a marked trend to the upside.
But Russell's comments point to that critical ingredient, I think one of many of the critical ingredients that investors need in order to be successful. And I think along with those things like patience, finding primary trends and staying with them,
right.
Very basic conceptually. But I recall conversations back in 2004 where investors of our company traded out of silver positions at $6 after an excellent purchase at $4.50.
Sure, they made a nice profit.
They did. And as far as I know, that person never came back into the silver market. The price has subsequently been to $8, $20, $30, $40, almost $50 an ounce. And what was lacking was patience. What was lacking was patience. Patience is challenging to come by, particularly when the news media conditions you to be compulsively taking action every 5 to 6 minutes. And you mentioned that earlier. The average interview segment on major news networks is 5 to 6 minutes.
Right.
That's the new idea. That's the new thing I should be buying. That's the new thing I should be Googling and looking up on Yahoo Finance. Literally, we think in those short snippets. We think like the trader. We think like the speculator. We're looking for the juicy news bit and losing the greater context, losing the larger context, and forgetting that over a long period of time, it's an investor with an insight that actually profits and does so handsomely.
Well, David, you know, this may sound ironic because you're just about to go on to a television interview right after we do this record, and you do that a few times a week, Bloomberg, CNN, what have you, CNBC. We really should encourage our clients to turn those channels off and not let them affect their pocketbook. Even though you're doing those interviews, we're actually probably saying don't watch too closely.
True enough. One thing we have to say before we wrap up is that the importance of this week in Europe can't be understated.
Right.
The European issues, you've got the summit this week. Of course, it's one of many summits that have been had over the last several months, and they've netted absolutely nothing.
Right.
Nothing has come out of them of any real substance. But this meeting may set the trajectory for the ultimate success or failure of the EU project. You've got Italian bank bailouts, which are occurring as we speak. The Italian bank I'm talking about is the oldest Italian bank going back to the 1400s. So you've got Italian bank bailouts, you've got the Spanish bond yields, which are bubbling higher, and they may actually have enough crisis in the air to do something. This is, I think, a key point, whether it's a U.S. political system or an EU political system that we're talking about. Politicians never take risks until they have nothing to lose.
Well, and that's once they milk everybody else completely, that's when they have nothing left to lose.
Right. So you've got Spain. Capital controls were introduced just here in the last couple of days. Minimum fines of €10,000 for non-reported foreign accounts and a prohibition of cash transactions greater than €2,500. That's for individuals and firms. So you've got the Spanish Treasury, which now sees that light at the end of the tunnel, and that light is moving rapidly towards them.
Okay. Well, then let's move to Greece. Okay. Greece, they were told they needed to start laying people off. They're not making their bills. They need to start laying people off. It's called the Troika deal.
The new government is attempting to renegotiate the bailout terms, and in the process of renegotiating the terms, which have already been agreed to, they've revealed that while they were supposed to be laying off state employees, they actually hired 70,000. 70,000? It's not like an accidental, we did have to hire a few. This is admin, health, police. This is according to Reuters. 70,000 new during the period of 2010-2011 when they were supposedly firing aggressively. Yeah, well, France, Michael Sapin, and I probably butchered his name, it's a French name. According to The Economist, he's the labor minister, and he's promised to make the firing process so expensive that French firms can't afford to lay off workers. This is mind-boggling. This is mind-addling. This is the kind of thing that leads me to say those damned socialists don't realize that when the firms that they're talking about look at that kind of imposition of regulation, all they do is quit hiring altogether.
Sure.
So they're trying to fix an employment issue by saying you can no longer fire, when what that causes is a French firm to say, if we can't fire, then we won't hire either. Or where we'll hire is in foreign subsidiaries where you can't tell us what to do.
So, David, it's a little bit like Hotel California. You can check out, but you can never, never leave. So you hire somebody, you can never, never fire them.
Well, but guess who is leaving? Guess who's leaving in droves? It's the millionaires of France. I mean, it's the most stable tax base that they have. The folks who pay most of the bills in France, again, this is insane. But Francois Hollande,
right,
as an election promise, has said we're going to increase the marginal tax rate to 75% for anyone earning €1 million or more per year. Well, they're already paying an astronomical price. This is the step too far. We're seeing a massive number of people who are moving out of the country, leaving altogether.
Well, and the millionaires that are owning the businesses, they can't fire people. So if they're not going to leave for the 75% tax increase, they're going to leave because they can't run a business by not being able to fire.
So you've got your key people at these firms who are requesting, and it's being granted, that they be relocated. Yeah, listen, I don't want to be here. Why don't you put me with our subsidiary in the Netherlands? Why don't you put us with a subsidiary in North Africa?
Right.
Why don't you put us with a subsidiary in the Caribbean or in India or in Russia? But this is the issue. You've got the wealthy French who are saying, I'm not going to generate an income here if you're going to tax me 75% of that income. So you've got executives that are being moved to foreign subsidiaries, the wealthy who are deciding that they're not that French and they're pulling up stakes. This is the new socialist regime, and it's destroying, as I mentioned earlier, the most reliable tax base in the country. France, Greece, Spain, it's not a pretty picture, and this is the backdrop going into the European summit on the 28th and 29th. We see everyone digging in their heels and getting very belligerent about their demands. New politicians saying we know exactly what we want, our constituents have given us power, but what they don't have is real negotiating room amongst this collective. And that's where we could actually see the breakup of the EU project. I mean, what has the potential to be utterly unifying, where politicians on a unilateral basis don't check in with their respective constituency groups and just sign over power to the bodies in both Brussels and Berlin, and here everyone's going in with an agenda. This is, I think, going to be a nightmare summit.
Well, and you know what's amazing to me? Germany actually is the country. We've talked about Greece possibly leaving the euro, Spain, Portugal, you know, Italy, Ireland, but actually Germany is the one right now that's saying, wait a second, maybe we're the guys who need to leave the euro. We can't handle this anymore. Even the French, when they're taking vacation, this shows how little they get it. Okay, the Greeks added 70,000 workers instead of subtracted for their austerity. All right. And then the French, they ask the question to the courts, what if I'm on holiday and I get sick?
So this is from the New York Times. Europe's highest court ruled that workers who happen to get sick on vacation were legally entitled to take another vacation. We wonder why Europe's broke. This is codified. This is law. This is, yes, if you got sick on your vacation, you deserve another vacation. And they don't take 1 week and 2 week vacations.
No, they're 6 weeks. They're 6 weeks, David.
Four to six.
All right. But we do know that August is coming. They're going to have to make all their decisions before the typical European holiday starts because they never let crisis interfere with vacation.
Very true. Very true.
Unless they get sick, you know, then they get another one. When does Germany call it quits? That's what I want to know.
They may look at this European vortex and just say, listen, thanks. It's been fun. And it's going to take us a long time to dig out of this hole. It may cost us 10% of our GDP leaving. But 10% of our GDP leaving is better than an endless stream of liabilities that we didn't accrue and we have no interest in. So don't saddle us with 10% of GDP in terms of liabilities and make us stay. We'd rather take the 1 year hit to GDP and leave and go back to the German mark. Kevin, I mean, it's this tenuous. It could, in fact, hold together, and it may, in fact, fall apart. The summer of 2012. What a fascinating time to be alive.
So, you know, and this is from Reuters, David, but the question is, how many Euro summits does it take to change a light bulb?
As many as it takes to get Germany to agree to pay for the new bulb.
Here's your new German bulb.
Kevin, as we wrap up, you know, we had in the U.S. a number of bank downgrades, and a part of the bank downgrades, we've had both the BIS and a number of other institutions say, listen, U.S. banks are not ready for the coming European crisis.
Right.
And they're not ready for a number of reasons. J.P. Morgan, this is a Simon Johnson article from Bloomberg, $4 trillion in assets, a hiccup at all, 1.25% of losses would be $50 billion and they'd be done.
Really?
Yeah, $50 billion.
Only 1.25%. That's a hit that a person can take in a single day, Dave.
The Dow has been up or down that amount. Gold or silver have been up or down that amount or more in a day, this week, last week, today. And we're talking about the value of a huge, huge balance sheet. If it fluctuates down as much as 1.25%, we're not talking about the London whale impairing the company. We're talking about the company having inherent risk on its balance sheet, which, if inadequately managed, this is the largest bank in the world. If inadequately managed, Kevin, It's mind-boggling. Yeah, so we've got the bank downgrades. Moody's is growing very uncomfortable, not only with Spanish banks, with over 20, 25 banks downgraded this week, Spanish debt downgraded, but also U.S. banks. All the big ones were downgraded. And none of this is in light of stress tests, which, of course, they passed with flying colors. All of the stress tests assumed that there would be no issues in Europe. There would be no systemic pressures. Why do you do a stress test if you're not factoring in major systemic issues? It was window dressing. It was a PR campaign to say, don't worry about your deposits. Don't worry about keeping your assets under management with us. We're a stable organization for all intents and purposes.
Obvious, David, that Rasmussen doesn't do bank ratings because the Rasmussen poll is showing that people aren't buying it anymore. Okay, we're starting to feel like we're in the real recession that we are in.
63% believe that we're already in a recession, and frankly, that doesn't bode well for Obama.
Right.
You know, and neither does the Supreme Court ruling this week on Obamacare. If it struck down, Romney's odds improved dramatically. Kevin, there's a lot that's happening of a political nature here in the U.S., a lot that needs to happen, frankly, of a political nature here. When we're talking about the fiscal cliff and what needs to be addressed before it's an emergency measure, before we're in panic mode, there's a lot more that needs to be happening politically, and unfortunately, nothing's happening there. This week, we need to watch very carefully what happens in Europe. Keep your eyes and ears open. And of course, Kevin, I can't help but remind listeners that this is the time where you have time. Summer months where it's a little quiet. Maybe you've got some peace and quiet. You can get out on the front porch and rock in the rocking chair or just get alone with your own thoughts. Whatever allocation changes you need to make this month, next month, over the next 2 to 3 months, because as we head into this fall, both with Q2 and Q3 earnings being soft and the Fed being intransigent this last week in terms of its support of the market, I think you're going to see worse numbers, not better, before the Fed does anything. The quantitative three idea, the idea that the Fed will step in and be sort of the Bernanke put, just like we had the Greenspan put before him, that may not happen until we're at a very painful level, 10,000, maybe even less on the Dow. And I think that the downside versus the upside is far greater in your general equity space. Precious metals are at their lows. Seasonally, this is where they hit their lows. We think that people should be very concerned about what's happening not only in Europe, here in the U.S., and next week we'll go back to our conversation with Minchin Pei, where we look at some of the hurdles that they have, both of a political and economic nature in China, and we'll explore that over the next couple of weeks as we're actually in China, but beginning that conversation again relating to China with Minchin Pei.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.